once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if you'd like to give us a call, and today is July 20th, 2019, where you are, you're certainly welcome to do so. 254-773-1400 is the number. And you can ask or comment or opine or whatever you want to do about anything to do with the economy, investing, money, finance, anything of that ilk. Do not ask questions about
an elk.
Well, I don't know. We could talk about elks.
That it was a Monty Python.
Yes.
You can ask about an elk, actually. We would know a lot more about Monty Python than about what you were about to say.
I was about to say professional sports teams or professional sports or sports in general, because we are abysmally ignorant.
Yes. We understand that the women's football team won the World Series this year somehow, and they will be coming back for
They were playing football against
the Bulls. I don't know. Well, so yes, the plumb the depth of our ignorance, if you dare, because professional sports is not what we do.
There's a guy in the office said, "I'm a great Eagles fan."
Okay, I know what a great eagle is. A bald eagle, any bald thing is great.
Oh yeah, I won't argue with that.
So that's a great eagle.
I'm still trying to understand why he liked. And I was thinking maybe he. I know Salado's mascot is the eagle, so he must be a great fan of the Salado sports teams.
Could be some other Eagles out there. I know there's a music group.
Oh, yeah. Well, they disbanded, I think.
I don't know.
So they were a band that disbanded.
What is a band that's no longer a band?
I don't know.
Or that band?
Let's talk about the economy for a minute.
Why would we do that on this program?
First off, I'll give you the big picture, then I'm going to give you some details, and then we'll come back to the big picture. We're seeing in the sections of the economy that are kind of called I've heard it referred to the screwdriver economy, the hard sections of the economy where commerce and where we create things and where we provide services. And when we do things that originate here, that people get paid to create something, they create a service or they create a product.
We're making something.
We're seeing them go flat to negative. An example that really confirms this kind of thing is the Federal Reserve announced this week that the U.S. industrial production was flat in June after increasing 0.4% in May. Industrial production is up 1.3% from last year, but in the second quarter, it declined at a 1.2% annual rate, which means industrial production has been. The future, we don't know, it goes down. But then we get another confirmation that I like in many ways a lot better. The Association of American Railroads.
Arr! Sorry, I can't help myself. That's the acronym.
They ought to have a group, and it should be arr!
Yes, it is the acronym for the American Association of Railroads. Arr!
They reported that rail freight volume is down 7.6% from June of last year. Now, back in the good old days when we had an economy that was primarily composed of production and transportation, the Dow theory said that the transportation index would lead the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And the reason is
because if you're making stuff, you got to ship it around.
Now, we do a lot more electronically today than we did then. Now, you might say, well, maybe they're just not shipping it on railroads. Well, the problem is with that
let's finish the Dow theory real quick, because I feel like we touched it, but we didn't finish it.
All right.
So the theory is that from the past, when we were fully industrialized society rather than a service-oriented society, we'd make things. So the theory was that the transportation index would lead the Dow because the transportation companies are getting paid to move things before the things that they're moving are sold at their end location. So if they're being shipped off to a storefront somewhere, the company that makes them doesn't get paid until after it gets shipped out there. So the transportation folks get paid before the industrial folks. That's the old Dow theory. We're not industrial anymore.
But let's just say they're not using railroads. They're using trucks.
Okay.
But the problem is that if you look at all of the freight volume, including truck, rail, air, and barge, it fell 5.3% in June compared with last year.
Yeah. So now, this now, is the old truck counting thing.
despite the fact that the quantity of oil that was being transported is up 23%.
Yeah, by railroad and by other forms of transportation.
So what we've got is a situation where the hard part of our economy, meaning solid part of our economy, where we produce things, services that we produce in the United States are also flat to declining. Now, retail sales are the exception.
Retail sales are up.
Admittedly, consumer spending is 70% of the economy, but it generally follows stuff we make and services we create in the United States. Now, the retail sales in the United States are up 3.4% from last year. The consumer is spending like there's no tomorrow, but the rest of the economy is going to either declining or flat growth rates, and that's something to keep your eye on. It doesn't mean we're going to have a recession. We've actually done it twice since the previous recession back in 2009. We've had declining rates like this.
And here's the issue. And this, let me kind of throw this out there. You said this, and it's an important factor. We talk about this a lot. 70% of our economy is consumers. Our economy is inward focused. We're self-sufficient. 70% of what we make is purchased by us. But we still have that other 30% of other stuff, other things, either purchase or sale, profitability, moving things around, that's not consumer-based.
By the way, that's a very healthy
situation. It's a fantastic place to be.
The Chinese would love to have a consumer-based economy.
They're about 50% consumer-based right now. They've just passed that mark, and they may be kind of peeking back in the opposite direction because they're slowing a bit.
As long as you're export-based, like Germany is, where their GDP growth rate is like 0.5% this year.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're export-based, you're dependent upon your customers, which are other countries, to keep your economy going. And if the other countries sag or put tariffs up or do something like that, you can be in a world of hurt in a short period of time.
Right. So you're saying, and you've said this just a minute ago, that we've been through two periods where industrial stuff, kind of the corporate chunk of the economy, started sagging and slowing, but the consumers pulled us through it.
Mm-hmm.
They kept spending. So the danger here is that now we're again resting on the consumers, and they're the most fickle. So a business will make a 12-month contract to do something. A consumer makes a "I'm buying this now" type decision. So it's good to have a consumer-based system. It means we have two legs to stand on instead of one. But one of our legs is a little shaky, and so you're going to hear a lot of people, hopefully a lot of the people at the Federal Reserve, are going to start talking good about the economy. You're going to hear good words said from the non-politically based people about the economy in the near future, because they're trying to bolster consumer confidence. Here's the issue. In an election at the presidential level, it is in nobody's best interest to talk only about the good stuff. You got to talk about where the other side is bad and where they failed, and that includes the economy. So even if we're in a really good economic moment, at a presidential election, the economy takes it on the nose, because it's in nobody's best interest to say that all the problems are solved and that the world looks good. So expect consumer confidence to take a hit. If that's the thing that is pulling us through this little slump on the industrial side, then we might see an overall little slump.
Well, consumer confidence actually dropped a teeny tiny, like 0.02% or something.
Right.
But
it's still really high.
It's still unusually high. And I've had anecdotal reports where people say, you know, you're so pessimistic in the letter and everything seems really good from my perspective. I feel like everything is just wonderful. Pay is up. We're seeing decent growth in pay across the country, faster than inflation. We're seeing unemployment at record lows or near record lows. We're seeing a lot of big positives across the economy. The problem is those are lagging indicators, and it's a good idea to keep our eyes open. I misspoke a moment ago. I said leading economic indicators dropped 0.2. They dropped 0.3%. Now, When did the leading economic indicators from the conference board generally forecast a recession?
When is it important?
When we go down 1%, and we're down 0.3.
We're not there yet.
Or down 3 months in a row.
We're not there yet either.
And so, but as I said earlier, in 2011 and in 2015, we had similar symptoms to what we're seeing right now. And we did not go into a recession. The key here is a really simple one. Businesses anecdotally are saying, we're not investing because of the threat of tariffs.
Right.
And if they don't invest over a long period of time, growth is going to grind to a halt. And if the tariffs out of the White House and the counter tariffs from our from the people the tariffs are placed on are probably the key to whether the economy sort of staggers along in a semi-stagnant condition or sinks into recession.
I've got asked this recently by a client, so I'm going to throw it out there. It's not the only time I've been asked. People talk to us about when we say leading indicators, lagging indicators. What are they? Where do we find them? How do we track them? Okay, the Census Bureau has a lot of them, but it's in really raw form. You actually have to know what it means and its relationship with the world. So let me give a quick brush up on that for those of you who knew about it before, and a completely new course on it for those of you that don't know what it is. What is a leading indicator? An indicator is talking about the future. How can you tell the future? Let me tell you some of the indicators that are leading. So a stock market, the stock market is a leading indicator. People are buying and selling their investments, hopefully after doing some research into the things that they're buying. They're not always right. But here's one of the reasons why we call the stock market a leading indicator. The stock market has never gone without a bear market before we're in a recession. The stock market, when we have a bear market, we've never had a recession without a bear market leading up to it. So the market knows there's something wrong. We as a general public, when we're investing, we do a little bit more research, not a lot more, unfortunately, but a little more. The stock market tends to be in a bear market before a recession. Now, the stock market has predicted 8 of the last 5 recessions. So it can have bear markets without a recession. So that's one leading indicator. Another one is manufacturing activity. You hear us talking about that stuff a lot. Inventory levels, retail sales, building permits, housing market, level of new business startups. Business startups are down. Housing market is not doing so well. Building permits are down. Retail sales are up. Inventory levels are up, but that's not necessarily a good thing. Inventory levels being up and could be an indicator for a negative there. Manufacturing activity is down. The stock market is up. So you can see why, on average, when we look at those indicators, they're only down a little bit. We've got some things in there that are up. So what's a lagging indicator? Lagging indicator, GDP. That's a really lagging indicator. What did we do last quarter? Well, we won't find out till a month and a half into the next quarter what we did last quarter, and we don't really know until the end of the quarter following that. And then you have a final revision 2 years later. It's a lagging indicator that we did well or we did poorly. Most recessions we go through and we don't know we're in the recession until it's over, because a recession is 2 quarters in a row of shrinkage, or as we like to call it in economics, negative growth. 2 quarters of negative growth doesn't have to be in a row, but most of the time it is. 2 quarters of negative growth, but we only know what the quarter's growth was a month and a half to a quarter later. So we're already out of most recessions before we know we're in them. And that's obviously a lagging indicator. Another one, income and wages, unemployment, consumer price index, currency strength, interest rates, corporate profit, balance of trade, all of these are lagging indicators based on what's corporate profits based on? Sales that already occurred. Unemployment, why is that a lagging indicator? Because people don't fire people because they expect a year and a half from now there to be problems in their business. In fact, they wait for the problems to occur and try to slog through it as long as they can before laying people off, because nobody likes to fire people. I know there's a myth out there about these nasty, evil people that just like firing people, but really...
There is one.
There might be somebody...
He said you're fired a lot on TV.
Right? The reality is that most people do not like to fire people. It's a nasty thing to have to do. And if it's through no fault of their own, it's even worse. So people try to hang on to their employees as long as they can. And on the other side, after a recession, after a downturn, they try to hold off on hiring new people as long as they can. They want to build up reserves. They never want to have to lay people off again. We're not there anymore. So that's why when people say, well, employment should be a leading indicator, all these people that have wages. Well, yeah, but the reason why they have a job isn't because they wanted a job. The reason why they have a job is because they wanted a job and somebody else wanted to give them one. And those are important factors. Leading indicators talk about expectations for future stuff and kind of status quo indicators are when people are buying durable goods. You know, these aren't things that are going to blast your profits off through the roof for the next 10 years, but it's something that says you feel comfortable about your own situation at the moment, and you're okay making a purchase that's a relatively high purchase, but one that should last you a long time. Okay, that was a rabbit trail that was more like a rabbit warren. Sorry about that. But we talk about the consumer-based economy. We talk about what we see happening. Another leading indicator is the inverted yield curve, or the yield curve in general.
And it went inverted. And it's almost inverted now. Basically, the bond market is predicting a slowdown in the economy next year and in the year following. Now, whether that slowdown constitutes a recession or not is the big question. So what do you do about that?
Well, we said last hour, you know, you see the barometer dropping. Know what you're going to do, number one. That's the first thing. What do you do in certain events? If your intention is to sail through the storm, set your intention now, because if you don't, when you're in the storm, your navigation might get a little wonky.
I saw something that if you have enough money that you're either approaching financial independence or you're financially independent. I saw it was in an industry rag. It's Think Advisor, which used to be Investment Advisor. There were just some headlines, and they were together, and I thought it was fascinating that the FSI – which is an organization of brokers, of stockbrokers, stock brokerage company, you know, the Edward Joneses and the Morgan Stanley and the Merrill Lynch and basically the brokerage companies, the big corporations, are make up FSI. And they are in testimony in New Jersey, because New Jersey is considering a fiduciary rule that says if you sell securities, you've got to act as a fiduciary. Now, that's a fascinating word, and it means more than best interest. It means the very best interest, and you must avoid or fully disclose conflicts of interest. You must basically work solely in the interest of your client. Now, brokers don't do that. They are held to a standard, which is called a suitability standard, and there's theoretically a best interest standard is coming out that doesn't really mean best interest. But the point is they're arguing against a fiduciary standard for the state of New Jersey. Now, that was a headline. The two other headlines on the same page were fascinating. They were major fines against broker-dealers for mispricing mutual funds. In other words, they sold mutual funds for higher commissions than was authorized by law, for churning, which means trading too much, and for failure to disclose information about securities that they were selling to the public. These are, and I thought it was fascinating to see them all on the same page, because here the securities industry, the FSI, their lobbying organization, is saying we don't need a fiduciary standard. And at the same time, on the same page, you see that the SEC and FINRA are fining the members of the FSI for cheating the public and fining them very large fines in the tens of millions of dollars. If you're in the position where you're approaching financial independence, or you are financially independent, you have enough money that you could live on, it is probably in your best interest to hire an investment advisor who will state in writing that they are a full-time fiduciary and they will not sell you anything. They don't get commissions. They don't work for a big corporation. They work for you. And one with appropriate certifications. Why do I say that? Because as we approach the next downturn, and there is, I can say with a great deal of confidence, there will be a downturn, having somebody with the education and who is interested in operating in your best interest, not selling you something, is going to be a critical issue if you have a large portfolio of investments. Now, if you have educated yourself and you have the equivalent of a master's degree or something in investment, or you have a certification, or you believe quite confidently that you understand asset allocation and the theories behind it in the economy, man, go for it. But if you don't, if you're dealing with a broker, a financial advisor, it is in their best interest to move your money around fairly regularly so they can make a commission. And it's in their best interest to offer you something that will get them a trip to Cancun or something. And just be aware of that as you go into this situation, that if you're in a position where the doctor gets paid by the procedure, they're going to have a tendency to prescribe a lot of procedures and it's going to be expensive. If you get in the position where your doctor is paid by a salary, they probably won't prescribe anywhere near as many procedures. And that's the same thing that's true in the brokerage world. It's true anywhere. Just be aware of that. If you have the wherewithal, the education and the intelligence and the time to do your own research and realize what is the best historic way to approach a downturn in the market. And by the way, it is not market timing. You can't figure out when to bail out and get back in. Nobody's ever been successful at that. Then do so. If not, you really need to be looking for a fiduciary investment advisor who will put in writing that they will say that they will do nothing but operate in a fiduciary fashion at all times while they're dealing with you. That was my soapbox.
Fantastic. Well, we've got some commercials to play. We can do that. Come back on the other side. We got more to talk about. We already talked about this a little bit, but Chinese GDP, what's causing that slowdown? I think it's an important thing to talk about. We'll come back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call in and join the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And Jake is going to tell us why the Chinese economy is slowing down. Not slowing down. It's just growing at a slower rate than
right,
it's growing. It's only
right,
growing at 6-point-something%.
The reason is because they have been basing a lot of their economy on trade. And We've been talking about how our gap in trade has widened during the trade war. Well, we're finally at the point where people are buying less from China. For all the way up till now, people have been buying more from China, and people are now in the United States buying less from China. What is that about? Well, we talked about last segment. We talked about how leading indicators and so on and inventories are a leading indicator. They can be a leading indicator in two different directions. And I'll bring this into China in just a moment. It can be a leading indicator if a business thinks that they're going to have a lot of sales in the near future, and that's the reason why they bulked up on their inventory. It can be a leading indicator for good things. It can be a leading indicator for bad things because the business doesn't necessarily think there's going to be a jump in sales. They think there's going to be a jump in prices, which they think will cause their customers to buy less. So they buy a bunch of inventory. That's a negative to leading indicators if they're doing it based on expectation of rising costs in their business structure, because it can leave them holding all of that inventory that they just bought if that event comes to pass and the prices go up too high. to cause the demand to run away. Less people will buy it. Even if you have a good priced item in a high priced item market, if the high priced item market is high priced enough, people buy less of it. And so inventory buildup has been the cause of many recessions in the past. Leading up to different parts of this trade war, and I don't mean just with China, I mean across the board, but China is definitely one of the participants. Leading up to this, every time a tariff is threatened, it's caused more purchases in China to get ahead of the tariff. Let me get a whole bunch of that stuff.
Purchases in China, purchases from China?
Both. So the people in China are used to shipping to other parts of the world, and people in the United States that are used to receiving stuff from China, both sides of that has had an uptick in purchasing. They're trying to buy stuff, and that's kind of a communal activity. The old moving trading spaces with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd, there is a group activity that takes place on the buying market. People get wrapped up in the enthusiasm around themselves, whether it's a good enthusiasm or a fearful one, to get in or get out. So when there's more purchases happening, some people purchase just to be part of the purchasing. Everybody's doing it. Quick, let's do it too. It's not a good idea, usually, to just do it because other people are doing it when it comes to money, but it still happens. So that's been going on all the way to about now. We've seen that flatten out and start to drop. What that means is that the real pain from the trade war is about to start hitting us and them. The prices are going to start going up, and you're going to have less things to buy. Because people, the purchasers are anticipating your purchase, and they've decided to buy fewer things because they think the prices are going to be too high. It means there's going to be fewer things around. So what that's done is that's slowed the growth rate in China. They're used to seeing the demand that the trade war has inspired, and up till now, it's actually been relatively good for them. And now it's not so good for them anymore. It's still not bad for them. That may come later. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, I like your China discussion. Isn't one of the problems with China the fact that they're real sketchy on their metrics? And is that kind of built into the investment equation for doing China investments? I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Yes. And yes. You want to take that?
Well, they historically have been. I think they're tightening down. They're trying to tighten down on it. And the other thing is when we get the report from China that they have a growth of 6.3% in GDP, there's a lot of people immediately go out there and start looking at satellite photographs of where the lights are on, and they look at imports. China can no longer hide its GDP as well as it once did. And when I say hide, they did a method of collecting GDP data through the Communist Party that was pretty inefficient and pretty ineffective. And then when they had these really high GDPs, they probably weren't high. And Jake mentioned some research done recently, published papers, that the GDP of China probably isn't 6.3%. It's probably closer to 4.
Right.
And the GDP of India is probably, it's simply because they're a developing country. They don't have a very efficient way of measuring GDP. But what we can do is we can look at it and we can say, we can see the number of ships that are transporting iron ore from Africa, that are transporting things that they have to import into China, and we can look at the coal that they're using, and we can look at a lot of things.
Yeah, their electricity usage is a big one. We can look from space at the density and brightness of their electricity, and that tells us an awful lot about economies. If you're growing at a 6 to 8% rate, you should expect to see electricity use going up by at least that much, and we haven't been. It's more like 4%.
So they're probably not growing at 6%, but they're probably growing at 4%. But still, that's a pretty healthy growth rate, which, by the way, their current growth rate, whether it's 6.3 or 4, is going on in an environment where their exports have plateaued. They've stopped growing. And now,
one of their growth
exports
areas
last year were 10%, had a 10% growth on it because of what Jake talked about of people trying to stockpile things. Whereas this year it's gone flat. Now, if you can grow your economy at 4 to 6% with no growth in exports, that means that their internal consumer economy is picking up the slack.
Their agriculture area is also picking up. So this is something that is a direct result of the trade war. Their summer grain crop is their record on history. They've never had this much grain produced in China for the summer grain period. They're trying to start producing soybeans. They're doing a lot of the stuff that they were buying from us before. They're producing now. Those are more long-lasting effects of the trade war. If the tariffs went away tomorrow, there are businesses that have been started in China to provide something that they're going to – those businesses are not going to go away. So the American farmer will forever have more competition in China because of this. And that's just a fact now. They're producing record amounts of agriculture products. That portion of their GDP is up 2%, which is extremely fast growth in agriculture for China because they've been shrinking in agriculture for years. They've been buying their food abroad from us. and we're seeing that turn around.
And we don't make any secret, by the way, that we think tariffs are a bad idea.
Unless they're being used as a negotiating tactic with a clear goal and a known success date.
Well, I say it's not a good idea, and the reason I say that, historically, tariffs have damaged both sides. It's just a matter of trying to figure out when the dust settles which side was damaged more. And historically, the side that put the tariffs up, that started the tariff war, got damaged more than the side that was attacked. And we do have a caller on 254-773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, brothers. Hey, when is China going to take responsibility and accountability for our OPM files and data that were stolen and Obama's aware of? And also,
you know what President Obama knows that the rest of us don't?
There's certainly no way that we can know when they're going to take responsibility for anything.
Okay, and then the other thing is does everybody know that China is colluding with Google on artificial intelligence, AI?
They had been. The Google project for the state-censored search engine this week, they canceled it. Google said, we're not doing it.
They did, but now they've stopped. Is that what you're trying to say?
I'm not quite going to believe that yet, but since they're doing everything they can to data mine everything about each and every one of us over here in the United States,
particularly if you work for the government
or anywhere else for that matter.
Yeah, there's no question. There's no question that China has done some data piracy, major data piracy across the United States. For example, let me give you an example. Are you still there? He's gone. Okay, let me give you an example of something you didn't know about. You know, Target got hacked, and a tremendous amount of personal data was hacked and taken from Target. It's a very significant. That was like over a year ago.
That was over 2 years
ago.
Over three years ago.
Here's the interesting thing. It has never shown up on the black market, which meant a state actor did it.
Or somebody that just did it to do it. But you're right. Those numbers, those credit cards and so on, never showed up for sale anywhere.
And this has been true of the major hacks that you've heard of over the recent past. OPM, as you mentioned, the Office of Personnel Management for the United States government. A lot of major hacks have gone on. They've stolen a tremendous amount of personal data that could have been sold for literally billions of dollars on the black market. And that data is just not showing up. So it is reasonable to assume, by the way, and there's at least anecdotal evidence, that Chinese intelligence is who gathered all this data. And they now know all kinds of things about various people across the United States, or at least they know what people were doing a couple of years ago. Here's the question. What good does it do them? And eventually they're probably going to figure out that knowing lots and lots and lots about lots and lots and lots of people that is not going to do them much good. They're not using it to attack the credit lines of people. They're not using it to steal things or borrow things. They're not using it to fake identities. Who knows what they're using it for? I think this is just my opinion. They're just testing the system and seeing where the weak points are.
Right.
And because cyber warfare is real and shots are being fired that we don't even know about.
Yeah. In fact, this doesn't take a conspiracy theorist. This is pretty easy. And there are members of the security community in our listening audience. Cybersecurity, there's a constant set of skirmishes taking place between nation states. Constant. They are aggravating each other on purpose with little annoyance attacks to just hacking in to see if they can. It's very much like the Cold War with nuclear submarine duels that took place between the Soviets and the United States that weren't – they didn't ever make the news until it was leaked about 5 or 6 years later that we were that close to nuclear war, and it was just because these two captains were playing chicken. Yeah, and we're doing that in the cybersecurity world all the time, only the games of chicken are much bigger.
I read a little report that went by, I think it was in the Wall Street, it was in the Financial Times, I think it was, a little report that went by that Iran was a little upset because they claimed we shut down their air defense system for about 30 minutes.
Yeah, we did.
they're not the only ones. People stealing lots of data about Americans that's mostly can be found in the public domain anyway is something that is, I hate to say this, but it's almost good for us. It's good for us because Target, obviously, we had some slack in their security system and they got a big fine and they've been sued. And now they're fixing, now corporations are busy fixing the holes in their security systems. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's me again. Hey, I didn't hang up. Somebody cut me off. Hey,
are you on the road?
So that means that, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So that means that the U.S. government fell down on the job in securing our information.
No.
Well, they did.
I think so. I think they did, sir.
Well, now the OPM obviously had a hole in his system.
No, I don't think it's just the OPM. I think that's the NSA. I think that's the CIA. I think that's the FBI.
The CIA has no authority to protect U.S. information.
And here's the deal. If they fell down, nobody's given the government mandate yet. Congress hasn't, we haven't, to say you must protect us in the cybersecurity world. And that's something I think we need to do. We need to say it because at this point there is no federal net of security to cover, for instance, municipalities. The city of Atlanta was hacked with ransomware. This wasn't even by a nation state.
You're right. I heard about that.
Well, is that whose role is it to defend the city of Atlanta? Is that a state role? Is it the city's role? Is it the federal government role? Yeah, we're all falling down on the job right now. This is like I like to use this example. It's really easy to cast blame on the government, but we have to come back to taking responsibility to giving the government the mandate so that we can blame them when they fail.
I mean, if you've written your congressman and said, we need the NSA to step in and protect our data.
Because that's not the NSA's mandate. They're an espionage organization. They're not for protection.
And we don't even want them looking at our data.
That's what we're talking about, though, isn't it?
Let me ask you a question. Do you have a computer?
I do.
Do you? How up to date is your internet protection software? You don't use your computer?
Nope.
Well, then you're a very rare person. But do you have a cell phone?
Nope.
Well, then you're cyber secure. But the majority of people that I have talked to who have computers have no clue whether their internet protection software is up to date or not.
And
I can tell you for sure it doesn't matter.
Oh, it does.
No, it doesn't.
Because it's easy to hack into a computer that's not up to date.
You think it does, but it doesn't.
I like your logic.
Well, I definitely think it does because there's a lot of data out there that indicates that it does.
The other piece, you know, this is, I've used this analogy before, is that when automobiles were first being sold, they didn't come with keys.
Yeah, that's I was going to say that.
When we have new technology, it's a bright new world. I mean, just think of the advent of Facebook. What kind of negatives were said about Facebook? Pretty much nothing. Everybody thought this is the greatest thing. Now what are we talking about? Privacy? Well, who shared all that information with Facebook? Well, we did. We loaded them up with our information because nobody thought, why would somebody use this? Who cares where I ate my lunch? Well, evidently a lot of people care where you eat your lunch. It's important enough that people are spending lots of money to figure out where you ate your lunch. And now we have this thing where we say, all right, how do I prevent my phone from telling everyone where I'm eating my lunch? Well, you got to unsign up for things. So security is not just with somebody coming to take your stuff, but it's also with the people who have loaned you stuff. This is not the first time it happened. I mean, how long was it that it was the norm to have your phone leased to you from the phone company and the operator could listen to all your phone calls? That used to, now we couldn't aggregate that all. We didn't have all the operators linking together to tell each other what was going on. So that, wait a minute, that was J. Edgar Hoover at the end of that, wasn't
yeah.
it? Wait a minute. So privacy is something, we're in a new era of privacy, but it's not a new threat to privacy. It's been around for forever. And this is one of my pet peeves. And it's a kind of a nice segue to the next subject. I had a package delivered to my house this morning from a Mercedes Sprinter van where a guy jumped out of it wearing an Amazon shirt and some other clothes too. It wasn't just the shirt. He gave the look to me over there. So he's wearing a whole outfit, but he's wearing an Amazon shirt. Well, why isn't that UPS or the United States Postal Service? Because the United States Postal Service has been picking up a lot of the slack. It's actually had a big impact on their bottom line. They're still losing a lot of money, but they're losing a lot less money than they could have. Well, Trump tweeted, the president tweeted, that Amazon's getting a good deal from the U.S. Postal Service when their deal was a competitive deal with the rest of the market gets too. So Amazon has been actively moving away from using the United States Postal Service. Why am I bringing that up when in a privacy conversation? It had nothing to do with Amazon and what they know about you. The reason why the United States Postal Service exists at all is because the founding fathers decided that we needed privacy because we were lacking in it. The privacy as a threat, as a security motivator, has been around since the founding of our nation and before, and it was one of the driving focuses of the founding of our nation. We're kind of giving that up by forcing Amazon to go through something else. I would really like to see the U.S. Postal Service start an email service that had the same protections as mail for warrantless wire searches and so on don't happen on U.S. mail because it's part of the Constitution. I think they would, if you could pay them 50 cents a year or something to run a server, they would have to downsize quite a bit, but they would still exist with a function. That was a pet peeve of mine and something I kind of wanted to throw that out there. Unintended effects of governmental pushes. The U.S. Postal Service may disappear. It may be Amtrak in a few years. It's already for decades been losing money year over year. And it exists for a reason beyond sending letters. Its reason is to send private letters that weren't searchable by the government unless the government had a really good reason that they could define to a judge for every envelope that they opened. And right now they get one warrant and they can read all your emails. One warrant was one envelope before. and that's something that is, I think it's an important factor. I mean, I really at this point have no problem with them reading my email. I think they can read the spam as much as I can, but there's a good reason to have that protection. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah, it's me again. Hey, Comey said you don't have any right to privacy.
Who said that?
Comey? As in James?
No, well, he didn't say that.
There is nowhere written in the Constitution that we have a right to privacy. If we want the right to privacy, then we have to define that as a right and vote on it. We haven't. The courts have said some things about the right to privacy, which is their definition. In that case, we have a court-appointed right to privacy. I think we're going off the rails a little bit here on the conspiracy theory stuff. There is a right to privacy, but it's not clearly defined. And if James Comey said we don't have the right to privacy, then that's his opinion, I guess. Because I think I have the right to privacy. At least in my home and in my car, I have the right to privacy.
Oh, do you have some more stuff you want to wrap up? What James Comey actually said is there's no such thing as absolute privacy in America.
That's
a true statement. Do we have a right to privacy? Yeah. The Supreme Court has held again and again and again that we have a right to privacy, but not absolute privacy. In other words, a warrant can be issued and you won't know anything about it, that they can look at almost anything that you have.
Part of the Patriot Act is that if you do suspicious-looking financial transactions, the government may be watching you. That's something we just have to accept. If you're doing financial transactions, we're in a government-regulated transaction environment. They can watch what you're doing.
It's critical to understand James Comey did not say no one has a right to privacy. What he said is there's no such thing as absolute privacy, and that is true. You think about it just a moment. If you're using a cell phone, you have given up some of your right to privacy. If you use a computer, you've given up some of your right to privacy, and you don't read the EULAs, the user end user license agreement.
Yeah, because they're basically 37 pages long, and
it says we can look at all the stuff you're doing on this piece of software. So,
but oh, goodness gracious,
that was interesting.
That was interesting. That's where that thing disappeared to.
All right.
The computer is moving stuff around on me.
And if I could throw one more thing in here about the economy.
Go ahead.
You know, we said that tariffs are a big experiment. We said the tax cut is a big experiment. Some of the results of the big economic experiment that's been going on out of the Republican Party and out of the White House have yet to be completed. We don't know for sure what the answer will be. One of the things that we do have some pretty solid answers for right now is the tax tariff on steel and aluminum is now old enough we can see the effect it has on the economy. And this is the amazing thing. It has not boosted employment or output for the protected industries. That was a key element.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, we're seeing anecdotal evidence right now that steel processors and manufacturers are where the layoffs are coming that are beginning to appear in the system right now. Interestingly enough, the hiring in industries reliant on steel and aluminum inputs did not fall off either. So basically what the tariffs did, the one thing we can say with some degree of security, what the tariffs did is they raised the prices that consumers are paying for items made out of steel and aluminum. Other than that, apparently we have a zero effect. So what Jake has said on several occasions, and I agree with, is that tariffs are taxes. And the bottom line to it is we got a tax cut and then we got a tax increase. And the tax increase is in the form of tariffs. Now, we haven't seen the effect yet of tariffs on China. We see that the Chinese exports have flattened. But this is an important thing. China does not run the majority of its exports to the United States. It runs it to the whole world. And the whole world economy is slowing down. How much of that is tariffs? How much of that is just a natural slowdown that occurs because of a cycle? We don't know at this point. But the jury is still out on the effect of the tariffs on imports from China. And we'll see how that one works out.
Right.
But the steel and aluminum tariffs apparently
on the cost of
didn't
steel.
Didn't do what they were intended to.
Right. The some of the report is back in that it's cost us about $900,000 for every $36,000 annual salary job that we've created in the steel market. And layoffs have started. So the numbers have to get re-updated with information about how long that lasted.
What he meant is we pulled $900,000 out of the economy and gave it to the government to create a $36,000 job in the steel industry.
Right. And the steel industry is laying off now. In Pennsylvania, the steel industry has begun layoffs not in huge numbers yet, but they didn't hire in huge numbers either. So we may wind up with a smaller steel industry than we started with. And we're about out of time for this week. That's a bummer to end on. Things are still good. Keep that in mind. Keep savings up and pay down debt. Things are going great. If the storm comes, have a plan in advance. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, you can call us locally at
254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can listen to radio programs, read our newsletter and our philosophy. You can also contact us on a contact form or send us an email directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.